Now this evening, in our survey of the Bible, we begin the third major division of the Old Testament. The Old Testament, 39 books, fall into four major divisions in the English Bible. The first five of those books constitute the books of the law written by Moses. And then come 12 books, which are historical books. And we have gone through those 12 historical books. And now we begin a short section which is comprised of poetical books. And so the third major division in the Old Testament is the division of poetry. There are five books that constitute the poetical books. The first is Job, then Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. Each of those books are poetry in the Bible. Now, what we would like to do before we get into the first of those poetical books is to make just some introductory comments about Hebrew poetry. If you were reading through your English authorized version through the book of Job, you would not suspect that it is poetry. And that is because in the authorized version, it is not written in the form of poetry. If you were fortunate enough to have a New American Standard Bible, then you would note that in that revision, they have written it as poetry. Now, why is it that you can read through the authorized version in the King James and never suspect that Job was poetry or that Proverbs was poetry? Well, it is because there is a difference between Hebrew poetry and English poetry. And so what I would like to do is to give you the three major characteristics of Hebrew poetry. The first characteristic is that there is, in fact, rhyme in Hebrew poetry. Now, if you have read through the book of Job, immediately your eyebrows will go up and you will say, rhyme? Why, I read through the whole of the book of Job and did not see any rhyming whatsoever. Well, that is because you were looking for the wrong kind of rhyme. English rhyme is by similar sounds. And we go to the end of the line and we notice that the last sound in line A is the same as the last fine sound in line C, and the last sign in line D is the same as the last sign in line D. And we know that we have an AB, AB rhyme in that piece of poetry. And so in English poetry, rhyme is according to similar sounds. Now in Hebrew poetry, it is according to similar ideas. And that is how the Hebrews found rhyme in their literature. Now I'm going to ask you to turn to Job, and I'm going to show you just a couple of illustrations of this so that you'll see what we're talking about. For example, turn to chapter 27, and you could do this at random in almost any of the chapters, but let's just turn to Job chapter 27, and I shall illustrate to you now what Hebrew rhyme really is like. All right, Job chapter 27, and take for example verse 2. It begins, as God liveth, who hath taken away my judgment, line 1, next, and the Almighty, who hath vexed my soul. Now do you see the rhyme there? There is a similarity, a parallelism in ideas. Go into verse 3. All the while my breath is in me, and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils. Verse 4. My lips shall not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. Now that is rhyme in Hebrew poetry. So there is a parallelism. And if you have a New American Standard Bible, you will be delighted in reading through the book of Job because it has it all laid out in its parallelism. One line parallel to the second, there is a rhyme, but the rhyme is that of idea rather than sound. Now in Hebrew poetry, the similarity of sound did not come until the 7th century A.D., so for many centuries earlier, there was rhyme in Hebrew poetry, but no rhyming of sounds, just rhyming of ideas. So Job is Hebrew poetry, and there is rhyme all through the book, but the rhyme is that of a parallelism in idea rather than in sound. Now the second feature of Hebrew poetry is meter. That is, there is a meter in Hebrew poetry as well. Now, it is lost when you read it in the English translation, by and large, because the meter is according to the emphasized syllables in the Hebrew text. So So what you would need to do is to take your Hebrew Bible and to read through a line of the Hebrew Bible with the emphasized syllables, and you would find that there is a very definite meter as you read that line according to the emphasized syllables. Now that's Hebrew poetry, and in the book of Job, as well as Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon, there is not only a parallelism in ideas, one line with the next, but there also is a meter that is involved. Now the third feature of Hebrew poetry is the great use of imagery, especially the imagery from nature. And if you have read through Job, then you will recall that there are many references to the snow and to the animals and so on. You're acquainted with that in the book of Psalms. And, of course, it's often occurring in the book of Proverbs. Hebrew poetry is very disposed to the use of imagery, especially from nature. Now, that's Hebrew poetry. And we're going to be looking at five books that will be poetic in our Bible. It is not to say that there are not pieces of poetry in other parts of our Bible, but these books are primarily poetical. Now, it is also important for us to note in our introduction to this division that some of the poetical books also are wisdom books. And in fact, the book of Job not only is a poetical book, but is a book of wisdom. There are three poetical books that are also books of wisdom. Those three books are Job, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes. Now, I want to explain to you again, by way of introduction, what a wisdom book is, because certainly Job is that, and also Proverbs, which will be much more familiar to many of us. A wisdom book is called a wisdom book because of its content. Its content is devoted to basic precepts and principles for a successful life, and for a life that will be pleasing to God. It is apparent that in the days of the Old Testament, perhaps beginning with Solomon, there were schools that were called wisdom schools. And these schools were comprised of men who devoted their lives to the study of conduct and ways of life, and then through the wisdom that God had given them, they formulated principles. And that's, of course, what a proverb is. It is a principle. It is a basic principle. If you do this, then this will happen. Train up a child in the way that it should go. When it is old, it will not depart from it. And by the observation of families, by watching children, observing conduct, analyzing conduct and its consequences, the wise men then formulated proverbs and these principles. So in the days of the Old Testament, there developed a group of men who were known as wise men. And these men were to have the answers to the situations of life when a person faced them. And they obtained those answers by observation and analysis under the guidance of God and revelation from God. Solomon was a wise man in that sense. You see, he was a wise man in that sense. And he was given that great discernment from God to analyze character and to study conduct, and from that to make his basic principles for a successful life, whether it be as a husband or a wife, as a parent or a child, as a businessman or whatever. The basic methods or basic steps to success are laid out for us in his writings. And also, of course, how to please God with one's life. Now, Job, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes are wisdom books. So in these books, we shall look for practical insights as to how to live our lives, to please God, and to have successful, prosperous Christian lives. Five poetical books, three of which are wisdom books. Now we're going to come to the first, which is both a poetical book and a book of wisdom. And the book that we want to study this evening for the time that we have is the book of Job. The title of the book is not difficult to understand. It is called, in all of our translations, Job. If we were going to take the name of this leading character and think that it was derived from an Arabic verb which meant to repent, then we would conclude that the word Job means one who comes back. And that is a very attractive interpretation of the meaning of this man's name, because as you see in the book of Job, here is a man who does waver and staggers a little and even makes some slight accusations against God. But at the end of the book, he comes back. In the midst of all of his suffering, he is staggering and stammering. But when the truth is revealed to him and he sees the picture as it is, he comes back to God with his confession and his submission to the will of God. So it is attractive to think of Job as meaning one who comes back. The word may be derived from a Hebrew verb, though. And the Hebrew verb means to hate or to be at enmity. And if so, one of the prominent Hebrew lexicons suggests that the word Job could mean an object of enmity. And that also is an attractive interpretation for the meaning of his name because, of course, Job became an object of enmity. And Satan turned his guns and took very careful aim on Job and his entire family, and they became the object of satanic enmity for an extended period of time. Whatever the name really means, we understand that both of these tell the story of Job as it is given to us in our Bible. The author of this book is just a little difficult to be too dogmatic about. What I think we can say, first of all, is that in all likelihood, the book was not written until sometime later after the events transpired. We are inclined to believe that the book was in fact written sometime around the period of Solomon. And that is because it is wisdom literature, and wisdom literature seemed to come to the fore during the time of Solomon. So we are suggesting that the book was written sometime after the actual events, which we shall talk about in a moment, but written probably during the time of Solomon, because that was the time when wisdom literature flourished in the culture and society of Israel. Who the author really is, we do not know. According to the Talmud, tradition ascribes the book to Moses. Now that will surprise you. But the tradition of Israel ascribes it to Moses. Now, of course, if it was written in the time of Solomon, Moses could not have been the writer of it. So we are not sure, really, as to what the time was or who the author really was. No one knows for sure because the scriptures do not make it clear. It would be surprising if Moses were the writer because it would place wisdom literature something out of the gender, out of the period of time when wisdom literature flourished in Israel's history. We can come on, though, and speak, I think, with some certainty concerning the historical setting of the book of Job. There are three or four things that I would like to say concerning the historical setting of this book. The first is, Job was an historical character. Now, higher criticism, liberal criticism, negative criticism of the Bible contends, of course, that Job was very much like Adam and Eve, simply mythological and legendary. It is from this story that you glean a very important lesson, but it is not historical, it is simply mythological. Now, I am not prepared to accept that position. I believe that Job was an historical character. There are two or three reasons for saying that. One of the most important is that in Ezekiel chapter 14, verses 14 and 20, as well as in James chapter 5, verse 11, Job is named by name. It is significant that in Ezekiel, he is put side by side with Daniel and another historical person. Three historical men are put side by side there. Job is one of them. The other two, we know, are historical. And Job is associated then with historical personages. So it seems to me that it would be apparent then from the fact that Job is put right beside Daniel and the other historical personage that it was understood that Job also was a real historical person. So we will accept him as historical. Now, the other reason is this, and I do want you to be very careful to understand this. It is this, that when you read through the book of Job, there is absolutely no indication to suggest that he was other than historical. Now, that is the argument that we would use for Moses, or the argument that we would use for Adam and Eve, or Noah. When you read through the accounts of the scriptures, these people are presented as historical personages. Now, when you come to the Bible, to something that is parabolic, it is always introduced as a parable. None of us believe that the prodigal son was a real person. And that is because before the Lord told the story, he said, "Now I'm going to speak a parable unto you." And it is identified as a parable. So none of us believe that the prodigal son was a real boy. But when you come to the story of Adam, there is no indication that it is legendary. And when you come to the story of Job, there is no indication that it is legendary. We shall note that in the very first verse of the book, it tells us the country in which the story took place. It was in the land of Uz. So we have no question then that he was an historical person. The second thing that we want to suggest is that Job was probably living during the patriarchal period. Now, the patriarchal period is the time of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. That is the period of time that preceded the captivity in Egypt, the exodus from Egypt, and the formation of the nation of Israel. Job likely lived at the same time as Abraham or one of the other patriarchs. Now, there are several reasons for suggesting that, and I shall mention them to you very quickly. The first and foremost is that Job also experienced longevity of life. That is, Job lived probably for 140 or more years. If we read the accounts and add together the years, probably he lived for 140 plus 70 years, 210 years. Now, that longevity of life puts Job back into the period of time of the patriarchs rather than the later period of time during which the nation of Israel existed. Also, through the book of Job, amazingly, there is not one reference to the law of Moses, not one reference to the temple, not one reference to the exodus from Egypt. Now, all of those would suggest that it took place before that period of time. Again, when you read through the book of Job, you're surprised to see a clan-like way of life rather than a national way of life. There was Job and his clan living together, and that was the way they lived during the time of the patriarchs. There was a clan way of existence. Also, in the book of Job, it's interesting to note that Job, as the head of the family, offered a sacrifice. Now, that is remarkable, because after the institution of the temple worship and so on, then the priesthood was involved in the offering of sacrifices. Prior to the temple, the head of the family, that is the father, was the family priest. And when you read in the book of Job going and offering a sacrifice, he is functioning as a family priest, offering a sacrifice on behalf of the family. And so it would seem that we are before the institution of the priesthood. And one other indication is that the wealth of Job was computed by the number of cattle that he had. And we know that that is also consistent with the patriarchal period, because we used to judge Abraham's wealth and Jacob's wealth, you know, by the cattle, the sheep, and so on that they had. So the second thing that we shall note concerning the historical setting is that Job took place probably a way back during the time of Abraham. So it is a very, very old book. The remarkable thing about this book and its incident is that it did not take place in the land of Israel or in the land of Canaan. Chapter 1, verse 1 identifies the locality. It is in the land of Uz. Now, the land of Uz is in North Arabia. It is east of the Dead Sea and Israel, just north of the land of Edom. So we know that the land of Uz is in North Arabia, not in Canaan, not in Israel. Now, the fourth thing that we should mention very simply is this, that in the book of Job, the names used for God indicate to us, I think, at least suggest very strongly, that this is not a Jewish book. It is extra Israel, outside of the Jewish people. The reason is this. The name for God, Yahweh, is Israel's name for their God. And remarkably, in this book, it only occurs 13 times. Elohim, the Gentile, the general name for God, is the name that is preferred in this book. El Shaddai, another name for God, occurs 31 times in the book. The point to note is this, though, that the name of Israel's God, Yahweh, occurs very, very seldom in the book. And that is in contrast with the other books that we would see in Israel's context at this time and later. So if we put it all together, the historical setting of the book of Job very well could be then that you have an historical person living many, many years ago, back in the time of the patriarchs, outside of Israel and the land of Israel, over in North Arabia, and it is not Israelitish or Jewish in its nature at all. And that will add some significance to what we are going to be studying in our book. Now let me just mention that the theme of the book of Job is probably the most familiar part of this whole book to us. Because the theme of the book of Job is, of course, the testing of the righteous men and women through suffering. Job is a righteous man, clearly established in the first five verses of our book. He is a righteous man, but he is tested, and he is tested by suffering. So the basic theme of the book of Job is the testing of a righteous person by means of suffering. Now you will note that that becomes very apparent as we move through the outline of this book. The book of Job is one of the most delightful books to study because its outline is very, very clear right on the surface. There are three major divisions in the book of Job. It begins with a prologue, chapters 1 and 2, and that prologue is prose. It is not poetry, it is prose. In the prologue, we are introduced to Job, we find out his circumstances, and he is an extremely righteous man, the most righteous man at that time on the face of the earth. We also note that in this prologue, he was subjected to the first satanic assault when Satan received permission from God to go and test Job by touching everything and anything outside of himself. And Job lost his children and his cattle and everything that was out there. The second assault under satanic attack permitted Satan to touch Job, but not to take Job's life. And Satan moves in, and you know the sequel to it. Job enters into a period of intense suffering. The affliction comes upon him. He is banished, perhaps, from the city. The next scene we have, he's sitting out on the dunghill. That was the place where they would put persons who were lepers, exiled, excommunicated, banished from society, and it perhaps was that the boils that were coming up on Job were suggestive of imminent leprosy breaking out in his body. So he was exiled from the city, and that's where he sits. Now that's at the end of the prologue. Now we are ready for the drama. And the drama is the extensive part of the book, from chapter 3 through to almost the end of the book, chapter 42, verse 6, the drama takes place. And this is all poetry. It's a beautiful, beautiful bit of poetry to study. Now, we do not have time to develop it, but I'm going to just take you through it quickly. The first part of this drama gives us the lamentation of Job. And in chapter 3, Job laments. Why was I born? Why did I not die when I was young? Why is my life ever being extended? And in the depths of anguish, in the midst of his intense suffering, Job laments. It's at that point that Job's friends appear upon the scene. And in chapters 4 through 31, there is the discussion of his friends. Now this is most interesting, and it develops very, very mechanically. There are three cycles. In each cycle, the three friends talk, and Job answers. So if you go through the cycles, the first cycle is chapter 4 through chapter 14. The three friends speak, Eliphaz first, then Bildad, and then Zophar. And after each one speaks, Job answers. Then the next speaks, and Job answers. And then the next speaks, and Job answers. And then there comes the second cycle. Again, the first one speaks, and Job answers. And the second one speaks, and Job answers. The third one speaks, and Job answers. And then there comes the third cycle. The first one speaks and Job answers, and the second one and Job answers, and the third one and Job answers. And that is how you move through from chapter 4 through 31 of this very interesting book. There is that dialogue and interaction between the friends and Job. Now, essentially, what the friends are doing is they are trying to get Job to admit that he had sinned and that what has happened to him was because he had sinned. Everybody else thought that he was a very righteous man, but they're really coming to him and say, Job, why don't you tell us the truth? Now, what is it that you've been hiding? There's a little double life there, isn't there, Job? Now, come on. That's why it's happening, isn't it? And so one after another, they move from various points of view, but essentially that is what they are trying to do. Job, this would not happen to a person who was as righteous as you think and seem to appear. There's surely something behind the scenes. Why don't you admit it and get the thing right with God? And so that goes on for those chapters. Then comes the third part of this drama. The third part is the intervention of Elihu. He appears upon the scene, and in chapters 32 through 37, Elihu speaks. And he speaks to the three friends, and then he comes back and speaks to Job, and then he turns to the three friends, and then he speaks to Job once again. And Elihu apparently is preparing the way for God to speak. There is a great difference of opinion as to who Elihu really was in character. Some people project him as the all-knowing theologian who appears upon the scene and says, I know everything, and he appears as that type of a person. But others present him, and I'm inclined to agree with them, others present him as the spokesman for God. And he is preparing the way for God to come and speak. And that is significant because God never reprimands Elihu, nor the things that Elihu said when he appears upon the scene. That brings us to the fourth part of this drama, and that is by far the most important part. It is the revelation of God. And in chapters 32 through 42, verse 6, God reveals himself. And the whole book has been building up to these chapters. There is a tremendous crescendo when you come to these verses. In these verses, first of all, God speaks. And in chapters 38 through 40, God speaks, and in his speech, he demonstrates his power in creation. Job responds at the end of chapter 40, and in his answer, he confesses his waywardness and his wrongness in accusing God. So there's a deep confession that comes from Job. Then God speaks again. And in chapter 40, verses 6 through 41, when God speaks, he demonstrates his wisdom in the government of the universe. And after he has gone through the illustration after illustration after illustration that has shown how wise God is in the administration of his universe, Job speaks. And this is how the book ends. This is how the drama ends. Job answers him. And in his answer, Job submits himself to God. Now, this is a remarkable part of the book. Because you will note now, won't you, in this part of the book, that God makes no reference whatsoever to suffering. Remarkable. God completely ignores the accusations of the friends against Joseph. It's amazing. Again, God in this part completely overlooks the very passionate words of Job against God. What does he do? He demonstrates from creation his power. He demonstrates from the government of this earth his wisdom. And he goes into the sun and into the stars and into the snow and into the animals, and he says, where were you when I put those stars in place? And how do you think those animals live? He demonstrates his great power and his great wisdom. And in response to that, Job bows and confesses his wrongness in asking why. That's the great point to learn. He realizes he was wrong in saying why. And then when he sees the wisdom of God in the universe, he bows before God's wisdom and submits himself to God. And it is through that confession and that submission that Job finds peace. in the midst of his suffering and trial. You see, in one sense, the book of Job is a great disappointment because it never answers the problem. Job, at the end of the book, never finds out why he was suffering. He doesn't know all about what's been going on behind the scenes with Satan and God. He doesn't know a thing about that. God has kept those curtains closed and completely separated from Job. Job's been saying, why me? I've been living such a righteous life. Why has this been happening in me? God, you are so unkind. You are so unfair. And all of the friends have been coming and say, Job, it's because you're living a double life. That's why. You're a hypocrite. Why don't you admit it? And all of this has been happening. And finally, God comes along and he says, all right, Job, I want to say some things to you. And he never explains why he's been suffering. Never explains his suffering. He just says, I am a powerful God. And I am an all-wise God. And Job, if you want to know anything about peace in your life, in the midst of the trial, it comes not by knowing why. It comes by knowing me and seeing me. And when you see me as I really am and bow before me as the God that I really am, then all of the trials and all of the temptations and all of the suffering will be accepted by you without all of the doubts and all of the questions and all of the accusations. You see, what God really says to Job is this. In the midst of all of your suffering and all of your pain and in all of your trials, in order to get peace, and in order to have peace and accept that, what you need to do is to see God. See me as I really am. And when you see me as I really am, and bow before me as I really am, then there will be peace. And there will be that capacity to contain and to accept it. It is faith in an all-powerful and all-wise God that gives Job the ability to accept his disease and sit in the dunghill, be banished from his community and accused by his friends. It's his faith in that all-powerful and all-wise God. Now you just examine your heart for a moment, won't you? When you had those troubles with God, when you're going through the time when you're asking why, what is it that really brings that peace and that contentment, that capacity to contain? It is not knowing why. That will not suffice. What really does it is knowing that above and beyond and in control of every string, there is a God who is all-powerful and who is all-wise. And all he asked me to do is in faith to accept this and to bow before him. And that is the lesson, I think, that really emerges from Job. The book concludes with a very brief epilogue, chapter 42, verses 7 through 17, which again is prose. And in this prose part, God speaks and then Job's prayer is given, and there is wonderful prosperity that comes to Job at the end of the book as he responds to God and submits himself to God. The great lesson of the book of Job, then, is his submission to the great, all-powerful, all-wise God. In faith, and in that submission, he found peace in his heart and the ability to stand before the Lord at this time. Now, in the last few minutes, I want to give some comments on some selected studies from this book before we move in and have some discussion and interaction on our lesson for tonight. I want to mention, if I can, several areas for selected study. The first, the book of Job gives us some amazing insights on the activity of Satan. Now, we do not have time to go into it, but I do need to mention it. When you read the first few verses of the book, you see Satan active. The interesting thing that will confront us, first of all, is that the name that is used for Satan means adversary. And that is what Satan is. He is our adversary. So the believer in the world today faces not only the world as an enemy and his own carnal sinful nature as an enemy, but he also faces Satan as his enemy. Satan is our adversary. And it's interesting in our book here that in his role as adversary, what Satan is doing is he is accusing Job. God comes to Satan and says, have you looked at my servant Job, how righteous he is? And Satan's response is, well, the only reason he is righteous The only reason he obeys you and the only reason he serves you is because you're so good to him. And so he begins to accuse the integrity of Job. And that is one of the dimensions of Satan's activity. The New Testament refers to him as the accuser of the brethren. And before God, he accuses us of unfaithfulness and of a lack of integrity and of lack of devotion to him. So Satan is doing that right at this position. He is our accuser. And it's interesting for us to note that in contrast to Satan's work as our accuser, in heaven we have our Lord Jesus, who is our high priest. He is our advocate. And he represents us and defends our position before God. So there is a very interesting judicial procedure that is going on in heaven constantly, wherein you and I are being accused before God by Satan, but our Lord Jesus, as our advocate, as our intercessor, stands on our side and on our behalf to defend our standing and our position before God. Satan is the adversary. He is attacking under it all, though, I do want you to note, the integrity of God. That is really what Satan does at this point. When he really is saying, the only reason why Job worships you is because you are so good to him, he is behind the scenes saying, either, God, you are completely naive, or you are lacking in integrity. Because you know that Job is not really a righteous man, but you are bestowing your blessings upon him as though he were a righteous man. So it is very important to understand what is going to happen in this book, to see that what Job does ultimately is accuse the integrity of God. You are dealing with him as a righteous man. And the only reason why he is that is because of your goodness to him. In fact, he is not a righteous man. So the issue involved, and do understand this, because I think you will not understand the book of Job if you do not see this. The issue that is really involved is that Satan is attacking the integrity of God. You are not really a God of righteousness because he is not really a righteous man. He is only serving you for what he can get out of it and because of how good you are to him. Now the third thing to note from the activity of Satan is this, that Satan is, although with great power, in every area subordinate to God. Satan cannot touch Job without the permission of God. My dear friend, Satan cannot move into one area of your life without God's permission. Satan is subordinate in every area to the power and authority of God. I think it is staggering to look at the first chapter, though, and be impressed with the power of Satan. He had the power to take the animals and all of the wealth of Job. Surprising to me, he even had the power to take the lives of Job's children. Satan has the power to take life. But that power is subordinate to the sovereignty of God. And he can never move into the life of a believer apart from the permission of God. Some very instructive lessons on the activity of Satan. This disease of Job is interesting from a medical point of view. We will not be able to take time to give you all of our arguments in defense of it, but it would appear from the evidence that is available to us that the disease that Job had was the disease called elephantiasis. That is a long I, and the emphasis comes right at that point there, elephantiasis. Now that is a very interesting disease, and if you look it up in Webster's Dictionary as I did, then you will find a very simple definition of it, and then read it in the book of Job, and you will find how interestingly some things in the book of Job come out that seem to indicate that this is the type of disease that he had. It was a disease that involved the breaking open of skin with hardness around the skin, and it bred worms within that sore, and that type of thing is commented in detail in the book of Job. It was a tremendously serious disease in that it caused a deterioration of the entire person, and you see that happening all through the book of Job. Now, our time is running out, and of course, I cannot conclude our lesson without dealing at some length, at least, with a major issue, and that is the problem of pain, or the problem of suffering. This is a major issue that comes to the surface when you come to this book. I was surprised to read in a biography of Charles Darwin that the thing that led Darwin to agnosticism was the problem of suffering and pain in this world. You will remember that he had been brought up a very religious man, as a matter of fact, was going through for the ministry. But the problem of pain was the thing that undermined his confidence in God. And he began to be convinced that as he saw suffering and pain and evil going on in this world, that it was impossible to reconcile that with a God. The conclusion that many make today is that either God is not all-powerful or he is not loving. If he were all-powerful, he would not permit this to continue. If he were all-loving, then he would not deal with it. He would not allow it to continue as it is. It seems impossible as you look at the evil in the world today and the suffering of righteous, innocent people. It seems impossible to reconcile that with a God who is all-powerful and a God who is all-loving. So we have the problem of evil, the problem of pain. Now, I think I would like to say several things about this in the last few minutes of our class. The first thing is this, that in the Bible, we do not ever have a complete answer to the problem of evil and the problem of pain. There is no complete answer that is given to it. As a matter of fact, oftentimes when you read through the Bible, you'll come to the same type of conclusion that you come to in the book of Job. And there is a disappointment that is involved there. Because in my rational approach, in my curious mind, I want the answer. Job was not given the answer. He did not know anything about the interaction between Satan and God that was all behind the scenes. Job was left without an answer. The only thing that he had to rest on was that his God was all-powerful and all-wise. And there is a sense in which that is where the believer stands. So we must be very honest with the fact and say that as far as we are aware in the Bible, no complete answer is given to the problem of evil and the problem of pain. However, the second thing that we can say with great confidence and assurance is that evil exists in the world today as a result of the rebellion of men against God. That is, it is as a result of the sin of men. In the rebellion against God, that evil entered into the universe, or entered into the human race. So the evil that exists in the world today is a direct consequence of man's rebellion against God, that rebellion of his own will as against the authority of God. We live then in a world that is contaminated by evil. And it is because man has rebelled against God. One of the things that God does with the pain and the suffering in this world is he tries to speak to men. C.S. Lewis once said, God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks to us in our consciences, but shouts to us in our pain. It is his megaphone to arouse a deaf world. Now that is very significant. And I have seen this happen so many times where men and women have turned in rebellion against God, and they have been deaf to the pleadings of God through the Word and through the kindnesses and goodnesses of God in their life. And then pain comes. The business collapses, the marriage falls apart, physical tragedy comes into their home, and pain hits. And it is then that they listen. What a tragedy that is so. But pain is God's megaphone to arouse a dead world, a deaf world. And C.S. Lewis was right on when he said that, and it happens many, many times. Pain exists in our world as a result of the evil and the rebellion of man against God. The third thing that we can say is this. If God were to wipe out all evil, then where would you be? Because you'd be wiped out too. So don't raise your voice to God and say, why did you allow an Adolf Hitler? If God were to wipe out evil men, you also would be wiped out. Because you are evil. Maybe not as evil, but you are evil in the sight of God, in your sinfulness, and in your rebellion against God. The fourth thing that we must ask is this. Suffering can be traced to several sources. And I am going to give you four or five of them. Suffering sometimes can be traced simply to the nature of the world in which we live. War breaks out, bombs drop. The bombs drop upon the righteous and the unrighteous. The wicked, sinful gambler in this house and the very godly young lady in this house are both killed by the same bomb. Evil happens. Tragedy hits. And it is just by the nature of the case. We live in a sinful world. We live in a wicked world. And oftentimes, the suffering and the tragedy of a good person, a righteous person, must be simply traced to the nature of the world in which we live. There is a tidal wave, and there is a massive earthquake, and the righteous and the unrighteous suffer, lose their homes, die. It is the nature of the universe in which we live. Sometimes suffering can be traced to the retribution of God. The Canaanites were annihilated. It was the retribution of God. In their sin, they had finally raised themselves to the point where God said, "You are a cancer in this world, and you must be cut out." And so he moved into them, and through the instrumentality of the Jewish people, he exterminated the Canaanites. At least that was what the Israelites were to do. Now, we have seen God do the same type of thing. God raised up the Roman Empire in retribution to fall upon the nation of Israel. And that has happened in history on many occasions down to our very present day. So sometimes suffering and pain is the judgment of God. It is the retribution of God against sin. The third thing is that sometimes pain and suffering can be traced to the chastening of God. That is, God allows suffering in the life of individuals to chasten them in order to bring out moral improvement in their life. Now, that is what the friends of Job thought God was doing to Job. They were saying, "Job, you know, there's some moral weakness in that life of yours. God is trying to clear that up. And that's why you are suffering." So as they looked at Job, they saw him with some moral defection, and God was sending this chastening in order to bring out moral improvement. Now, that happens many times. We know from Hebrews chapter 12 that is one of the major purposes of chastening in the life of a child of God. It is to bring about moral development so that the person will be more devoted to a godly life and a holy life. Sometimes it can simply be traced to the wisdom of God. God, in his wisdom, sometimes allows trials in order to develop Christian character. We know that all things work together for good. What good could some things work together toward in your life and my life? Well, verse 29 of Romans chapter 8 says that we have been predestinated to be conformed to the image of his Son, Jesus Christ. And so God allows things to happen in our lives. He allows us to suffer. Not because we have sinned, not to punish us, not his chastening, but in his wisdom, he allows a disease to come. In his wisdom, he takes home a loved one. In his wisdom, he causes a business failure. In his wisdom, he moves in order through that trial, through that suffering, to cultivate and develop the character of a child of God so that you will be more conformed to the image of Jesus Christ. Now, there's so much more that can be said on it. 1 Peter chapter 1, it is through this that faith is developed in a believer. James chapter 1, it is through this that perseverance, steadfast endurance, a very, very beautiful quality is developed in the life of a believer. So when we suffer, we do not always trace it to sin. We do not always say that this is the chastening of God or this is retribution from God. What we can sometimes say is, this is simply the wisdom of God working at this time in my life to develop Christian character in some particular way. In Job, though, the suffering of Job is to be traced to the vindication of God. And that is, I think, the great lesson in this book. Job never realized that his suffering and his patient endurance at this point was actually vindicating God before Satan. That is one of the most remarkable things in all of your Bible. Job's steadfast endurance was a vindication of God before Satan at this particular time. I do not know how often that happens in this universe, but because it is recorded in the book of Job, I am sure it happens many times. And there are many, many times, my dear friend, perhaps when your situation is very similar to Job's, and your trial, your testing, is actually an occasion, an opportunity, for God to be vindicated in the presence of Satan and all of the hosts of darkness. I think that is an amazing thing. I would love to have been able to tell Job what was happening, but God did not want Job to know. But now he knows, of course. And what a thrilling thing it must be for him to be able to look back on that suffering and that trial in his life and realize that by the grace of God, he so stood it that God was vindicated in the presence of the unbelievers and the wicked Satan in heaven. Now, we do not have time to develop any further points, but there are just two or three other things that we were going to mention, but we will leave them at this point and simply say, well, I should say this last thing. Let me just mention this last thing, that in relation to evil, God has moved to solve the problem. And the solution, of course, has been that he gave his son to die for our sins. And so although the whole problem of sin is not explained to us today, we know that God has taken action in order to deal with the problem of your sin. And that action is that he gave his son to die for your sin, so that your sin could be forgiven and dealt with in such a way that you could enjoy communion and fellowship with God, even though you are a sinner deserving the wrath and judgment of God. Now that is the book of Job, at least part of the book of Job. It's an introduction to the book of Job, and I hope that it will help us to somehow sense something of what is happening through the book. All right, before we close, we have still 5 or 6 minutes. Let's have some questions and anything that you would like to ask about or some contribution that you would like to make to our subject tonight would be appreciated. Yes, sir. You mean where it comes in the book of Job? All right. Okay, very interesting. The question is concerning perhaps one of the most familiar phrases in the book of Job. I know that my Redeemer liveth. And it's a very, very beautiful text. What the question is, you know, if this was written so early at the time of the patriarchs, then that is a remarkable statement. And what it indicates is that the faith or the belief in a Redeemer was a very ancient faith and belief. And even there is in that passage the doctrine of resurrection taught. So that away back then, at the time of Abraham, the doctrine of resurrection was believed, which of course does not surprise us, because he offered up Isaac believing that God would raise him from the dead. So Abraham believed in a God of resurrection, and Job also did. He believed in a God of resurrection. So it can be right back to that patriarchal time. There is the acknowledgement of a living Redeemer. God was his Redeemer, and that God was a God of resurrection. Okay, anything else? Yes, ma'am. No, the question is, does Satan know what we are thinking? Right, no, he does not know our thoughts. He is not omniscient. No, no. Well, no, Lamentations is poetry, but it is associated really in the canon as the epilogue to the book of Jeremiah, because it was written by Jeremiah, and when we get to Jeremiah, we'll see what a crucial place it plays with that book. So you are correct that there is poetry in Lamentations. It is poetry, but it is not listed among the poetical books, because it really is an appendix to the book of Jeremiah, okay? I think it's very important for us to realize that Satan is not omniscient. He makes his plays and program for our lives on the basis of the normal procedures that he has observed in men's lives. That is, he has worked for hundreds of years with men and women, and he sees how men and women with certain character and certain personalities react under certain circumstances. And it's on the basis of that type of observation and knowledge from dealing with hundreds of thousands of people just like you that he says, now, normally, this is how she will react in that situation, and he moves in, but there is no omniscience that is involved in this way. He will move with a certain temptation because he knows that people with this particular personality all down through history have been very susceptible to that temptation. This type of thing. It's very interesting, by the way, to see that Satan turned and he accused Job of living a righteous life because God was so good to him. Now, how did Satan know that? Well, it's just because, if what I am saying is correct, that he had observed that on the part of so many before. That when he comes along and sees Job living that godly life, he says, now, if this person is anything like the hundreds of thousands of other people I've seen, the only reason why this fellow is living the way he is because God is so good to him. And so he makes that accusation. He does not know, but he makes that accusation on the basis of his observation of Job as against the many hundreds of thousands of others that he's observed prior to the time of Job, which is a very interesting commentary on what Satan has observed as he's looked upon men and women. And I wonder if he were to look upon us and say, you know, well, as I look across the churches of America and see people in Bible classes, the only reason why they're there is because God is so good to them. Let God take away some of those blessings and send some trials into their life. I wonder then how they would act. And you may be able to pinpoint certain ones of us and make the same type of accusation against us before God because he has observed it on the part of literally thousands of people in America this very past year. Very interesting, very challenging. Yes, sir. Well, I didn't say sins. What I said was that there is the enemy, the opposition. Satan opposes us, the flesh opposes us, and the world opposes us. So there is a sense in which there are three opponents that are playing against us in our Christian life. And there are certain things that are the sins of the flesh. And we sin, we do those things because it is the flesh. It is the natural lust of the flesh. We do other things because it is satanic influence. And we do other things because of the attraction of the world. Now, I frankly feel that we give Satan much more credit than really he deserves. I think most of our sins are sins of the flesh. That is, we are primarily enticed into sin by pride, by lust, by envy, by ego. You know, that is self. That is lust. That is my own nature. And I think that, you know, when you look at the drunkard, you do not say that's what Satan did to that fellow. Say that's what the flesh did to that person. That's the result of the flesh. Satan's primary area of enticement is in relation to false religion. That is Satan's area. He is the counterfeiter. And if you want to see Satan's man, if you want to see the finest product that Satan produces, you do not look at Skid Row. You do not look at the prostitute house. Satan's finest person is the religious, self-righteous man or woman who stands behind the pulpit and who holds the Bible and stands with all of their self-righteousness. Now that is Satan's man. That is Satan's woman. That is what Satan works to produce. Self-righteousness. That is a counterfeit of the righteousness of God. So if I were to look for Satan's influence in America today, I do not really look at the drug scene, or I do not really look at the immorality, or necessarily the revolution. That's the flesh. If I were to look for Satan's activity, I would look at the occult. And I would see Satan moving with various substitutes for the faith and for the genuine truth of God, and leading people into various aspects of the occult so that there will be a false security and a false righteousness.